Welcome to Virex Database and Methods Cyber Seminar entitled Blood Pressure Measurements and Their Application for Outcomes Research in the CDW. Thank you to CIDR for providing technical and promotional support for this series. Today's speaker, Dr. Kavesi, is Nephrology Section Chief at the Memphis VA Medical Center, and Fred Hatch, Professor of Medicine and Nephrology at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center. He is an outcomes researcher whose main research interests are predictors and therapeutic interventions for cardiovascular and other clinical outcomes in patients with non-dialysis chronic kidney disease. Questions will be monitored during the talk and will be presented to Dr. Kavesi at the end of the session. A brief evaluation questionnaire will pop up when we close the session. If possible, please stay until the very end and take a few moments to complete. I am pleased to welcome today's speaker, Dr. Kavesi.
Thank you, DeAndre, and welcome everybody. Welcome to today's seminar series. Thank you for the introduction. As you heard, my name is Csaba Kavesi. I am a nephrologist at the Memphis VA. And today's topic is blood pressure measurements and the application for outcomes research using the CDW. The objective of the discussion would be to review blood pressure measurements as a variable in the National VA research databases, where it's located, what the file structures are, what ancillary variables you can expect, and what its availability is, and then examine practical aspects of how to analyze blood pressure in this database. Finally, and this will really be the bulk of the talk, would be a discussion about recent studies that we have published about examining blood pressure in the database and how it could be used in outcomes research. Now, before we get started, we have some poll questions. The first one would be about your primary role in the VA.
And the options here are primary care specialty provider, mental health provider, nurse, researcher, or administrator. We'll give you all just a few more moments. The responses are coming in, but I'll give you just a few more moments before I close this poll out. Just waiting for things to slow down a little bit, and I'm going to close it out here. So we're seeing around 5% saying primary care or specialty provider, 0% mental health provider, 15% nurse, 63% researcher, and 17% administrator. Thank you, everyone, for participating.
Okay, thank you. And we have a second poll question about your experience using blood pressure in your research.
And the options here are heard of it, but no experience using it, I have experience using it, or not heard of it, / no experience using it. We'll give you all just a few more moments to respond before I close things out here. And it looks like responses are slowing down, so I'm going to close. And we're seeing 31% saying they have heard of it but have no experience using it, 62% saying they have experience using it, and 7% have not heard of it or have no experience using it. Thank you, everyone, for participating.
Yes, thank you. So perhaps not surprisingly, I suppose that those of you who are researchers have used it because it's really a commonly used variable. So a little bit of background. As you know, blood pressure is measured on virtually all veterans who receive clinical care. I mean, that's for all inpatient encounters, outpatient encounters, is part of actually the check-in process oftentimes. Hypertension is usually defined as an elevated blood pressure. We will discuss this in a little bit more detail later, but a blood pressure higher than 140 over 90 is in general considered hypertension, and it is considered the number one risk factor for cardiovascular morbidity and mortality worldwide. In the VA system, there is a very large number of blood pressure measurements, which really offers a unique opportunity for outcomes researcher like myself. Now, blood pressure measurements can be found in the vital signs domain. The CDW contains vital signs from all sites starting October 1st, 1999. So that's just about 17 or 16 and a half years or so. Overall, there are about 2 billion records, considering all different vital signs, but this is a few years old, so we're probably past that number. The data is refreshed every night, so it is really up to date. And there is a number of linked tables in the vital sign domain. And this is basically a summary of what you find. You have the link there on the internet if you want to check it out yourself. And just pointing out that on this list, you have the systolic and diastolic blood pressures as separate variables. They're not under the results or the results numeric, which contain a lot of ones. In fact, blood pressure is included under those two, but you can have them as separate variables in this table. And then one other one that is obviously of interest is the time and date when the measurement was taken. Now, in terms of metadata, you have two tables, the vital sign table and the vital type table. And you can see the VISTA files that they are extracted from for those of you who are interested in these very fine details. And at the bottom, you can see the link to the table descriptions on the SharePoint metadata report. Now, a few details about the data profile that's available. You see on the left side the list of various vital signs that are recorded, and you will see that they vary in frequency. For example, pain and what's underlying blood pressure are measured very, very frequently. This data is from April 2011. And at that point, there were about 369 million blood pressure measurements. But for others, these occur much less often. And depending on which one you want to use, you have to decide if that's sufficient for you or not. We see the same numbers by year, again, as of April 2011. And as you can see, the measurements were recorded first time in 1999, and there was an uptick in the number of measurements every year, again, probably reflecting the changing demographics of the VA with the increasing number of patients being enrolled, and 2011 is a partial year, so it's not indicative of fewer measurements, really. What are the limitations of the database? And these are inherent of the database itself. There is no unit of measurement that you will find, so you will have to go back to your documentation to determine, for example, that height is measured in inches, weight in pounds, respirations in breaths per minute, pain has its own scale, pulse and temperature, as you can see. Obviously, blood pressure is measured in millimeter mercury, probably is not a problem. Most of us know that. It's important to know that there are no qualifiers in the database. So you will not know, for example, details such as which arm the blood pressure was taken from or whether there were any circumstances that might warrant special considerations. All you have is a number and a time and date. Here is your summary of links if you want to obtain more information. And again, these will be available for you for download if you want to check it out yourself. Now, what are some of the practical aspects? And I wanted to point some of these out because I've learned them in the course of using the variable. Obviously, first time you start using blood pressure, you have to clean your data, and you will consider systolic and diastolic blood pressure as two separate numeric continuous variables. There are some rules that you can use when determining which measurements may be erroneous, maybe typos. Biologic plausibility obviously helps. Although I have to tell you that there is no uniform rule for what numbers are acceptable, so it's more of a common sense type of approach. For example, for systolic blood pressure, measurements above 300 are fairly unlikely, although if you have a measurement of 310, you could argue that it's possible, although fairly unlikely. Obviously, if you have a measurement of 1,000, that is completely unlikely. So you will have to draw an arbitrary line at some level that seems reasonable. The same could be said for a diastolic blood pressure of 200. I've used myself these two cutoffs for higher limits of blood pressure. There is really no plausibility rule for what could be considered a lowest value. Obviously, zero values are not possible, so those you could exclude. And then I've used diastolic blood pressures of less than 10 and systolics less than 40 as arbitrary cutoffs. for potentially unreliable measurements. It's important to note that blood, systolic and diastolic blood pressures go hand in hand, so the measurement yields both. There is a very, very small number of measurements where systolic blood pressure is not accompanied by diastolic blood pressure, and I usually exclude those. Again, they're so small that they don't have a significant bearing on your results when you analyze them. And obviously, systolic blood pressure has to be always higher than diastolic. Again, there is a very small number of measurements where your diastolic blood pressure is higher than systolic. Maybe they're recorded erroneously as systolic and diastolic, vice versa. It's probably safest to exclude those. A few words about the date and time of blood pressure measurement. It's important to note that the format used in recording it is year, month, day, hour, minute, and second. And that's important because, as you know, blood pressure could be measured several times a day, so you cannot just record the day. And when you use these for your analyses, you'll have to consider how you want to include it. Again, you could include all the measurements, you could average them, you could use individual values as long as your date variable is coded appropriately. A few interesting points here is in patients who are hospitalized, oftentimes or routinely their blood pressure is measured several times a day, and you may want to consider each one of them separately in this context. On the other hand, if you have outpatients who come to clinics, you may see multiple measurements the same day because the patient had multiple visits on the same day, in which case they may be all valid single measurements. However, you may see the same blood pressure measurement repeated within the same clinic visit, outpatient clinic visit, and that to me may be a red flag because oftentimes blood pressure is, for example, not measured under standard circumstances. The patient might have just rushed up the stairs or be upset, in which case blood pressure may be artificially elevated and the technician may decide to repeat the blood pressure up in 10, 15 minutes. In cases like this, I tend to only consider the last blood pressure measurement related to that particular clinic visit. So now that we're delving more into the research side of it, we'd like to have some poll questions just as a segue into the research part. So this question asks you about what the ideal target blood pressure is in patients with essential hypertension.
And I feel bad here. I am not a subject expert, so I'm actually not exactly sure how to read these. Dr. Kubeski, I'm not sure if you could read through. That would be wonderful.
The first one is less than 130 over 80, less than 140 over 90. The third one is anywhere between 130 to 140 over 80 to 90. And the fourth one is less than 120 over 80.
Wonderful. And the responses are coming in. We'll give you all just a few more moments to respond here, and then I will close it out. And it looks like things are slowing down. We are seeing 8% saying less than 130 over 80, 50% saying less than 140 over 90, 18% saying 130 to 140 over 80 to 90, and 25% saying less than 120 over 80. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, and very interesting results. And again, this is a controversial topic, and I'm not really sure that there is a single correct answer. That's my prerogative to put up questions like this, and I apologize if that upsets you. But I just wanted to illustrate that this is really not an easy question, and it really depends on what kind of patient we discuss. Aside from having essential hypertension, they may have comorbidities, which may push you to choose one or the other blood pressure target, and maybe the data that I'm showing you may make this easier to understand. So here's another one, and again, this may not be totally straightforward. Elevated blood pressure is associated with adverse outcomes in which populations? And first one would be all populations. Second choice is in those with no comorbidities. Third one, in advanced chronic heart failure, or the fourth one, in patients on hemodialysis.
And responses are coming in. We'll give you all just a few more moments to fill that out before I close it out here. Okay, looks like things are starting to slow down. So we are seeing 82% saying all populations, 0% saying in those with no comorbidities, 16% saying in advanced chronic heart failure, and 2% saying in patients on hemodialysis. Thank you, everyone.
All right, thank you. Very interesting results. And again, probably all populations is true, but you might ask, what does elevated blood pressure mean? So we'll delve a little bit into that too. So let's discuss our first topic, blood pressure and mortality. Okay, high blood pressure is regarded as a causative factor when we discuss adverse outcomes such as mortality or cardiovascular events. And in general, we agree and everybody agrees that treating elevated blood pressure is beneficial. However, when we see what the blood pressure guidelines in general tell us, these guidelines tend to focus on the highest of the two blood pressure components. Remember that we have a systolic and a diastolic component, and if we define elevated blood pressure or hypertension as more than 140 over 90, then either component, if it's higher than the particular threshold, whether it's systolic or diastolic, that patient is considered to have hypertension. However, oftentimes we have a discrepancy. So, for example, a patient with a blood pressure of 160 over 70 would have systolic hypertension. The diastolic component is 70. It's in normal range, really. And in this case, the guidelines tell us to lower systolic blood pressure to less than 140. Conversely, a patient who has a blood pressure of 140 over 100 has diastolic blood pressure. 140 is right around the treatment target that you would want to use. But in this case, your primary target, according to the guidelines, would be the diastolic blood pressure. You're wanting to lower it to below 90. The problem that arises is that in certain studies and in certain populations, there is a so-called J-shaped or U-shaped phenomenon, in which case we can assume that in some patients, lower systolic and lower diastolic blood pressure could also be associated with higher mortality. And also, when you treat systolic and diastolic blood pressure, you lower them concomitantly. So if your goal is to lower systolic blood pressure, you will willingly or inadvertently concomitantly lower diastolic blood pressure as well. If we assume that there is a J-shaped phenomenon, this may mean that while you're lowering, let's say, your systolic towards a desirable range, you may be inadvertently pushing your diastolic into an undesirable range. And the current guidelines and current knowledge doesn't address this conundrum sufficiently. The other point here is that the treatment targets are much less well-defined for patients with chronic kidney disease. Now, I'm a nephrologist, so it's my main area of interest. And the main reason for that is that most hypertension treatment trials have excluded patients with chronic kidney disease or end-stage renal disease a priori. So most of the guidelines regarding CKD patients are based on extrapolations from clinical trials that were performed in non-CKD patients. So the first paper we'll be discussing is the one where we examine blood pressure and mortality in U.S. veterans. This was published a couple of years ago. And we started with about 4.3 million patients who had available serum creatinine and eGFR measurements over a two-year time period. And of these, we used an algorithm to define prevalent chronic kidney disease, and we had about 650,000 of these patients. These were non-dialysis-dependent CKD patients. We obtained outpatient blood pressure measurements over a seven-year period from enrollment until the end of our follow-up at that point. We obtained ancillary covariates. You see them listed there from various sources in the VA database. And information about all-cause mortality from the vital status files. First, we examined systolic and diastolic blood pressure separately as continuous variables. As we expected, nonlinear associations, we used splines to examine this. And then we also took a look at the actual blood pressure, meaning the combination of systolic and blood pressure at an individual level. First, we used categorizations according to JNC7 hypertension definitions using normal prehypertension, stage 1 and stage 2 hypertension, again using usually the highest of the two components to categorize patients in any of these four mutually exclusive stages. And then to take a more granular look at blood pressure, we examined mutually exclusive combinations of systolic and diastolic blood pressures where we took very granular categories of 15 categories for systolic and 10 categories for diastolic blood pressure. for example, this way we could examine a blood pressure of 150 over 60 and its changes in an individual patient, or maybe a blood pressure of 80 over 40. We first examined associations with all-cause mortality in crude analyses and then adjusted for potential confounders in time-dependent Cox models. Some general data. As you can see here, perhaps not surprisingly, this was an older cohort. These were CKD patients, which is typically a disease of older individuals, mean age being around 73 years. And our mean estimated GFR was right around 50, so CKD stage 3A, with quite a few patients with more advanced stages, though. Our mean blood pressure levels at baseline were 135 over 72. Again, probably a testament of a good job that nephrologists with the VA. This is actually not a bad blood pressure control for patients with CKD. Just very briefly, and sorry about the complicated slide, just wanted to point out a few things here in the baseline characteristics. According to the JNC7 blood pressure categories, on the left you have patients with quote-unquote normal blood pressure, and then pre-hypertension stage 1 and stage 2 hypertension. That's not surprisingly, African-Americans were more represented in the higher blood pressure categories. Comorbidities were in general more common in those who had higher blood pressure, except for CHF, notable exception here, which was much more common in patients in the lowest blood pressure, so I'm not really sure that we can call this normal blood pressure, in fact. Medication use usually tracked blood pressure levels, in that antihypertensives were used more often in those with the highest blood pressure levels, except for loop diuretics, which were more common in the low blood pressure group tracking the CHF diagnosis. Cholesterol was in general higher in those with higher blood pressure levels. Now, of these 650,000 plus patients, 238,000 or so died with a pretty high mortality rate, but again, something that we've seen in other CKD cohorts. A median follow-up was 5.7 years, and when we looked at the association between systolic and diastolic blood pressure, we saw a U-shaped association, which was our hypothesis from the get-go, and you see the actual associations shown here. Now, when we consider treating these blood pressure, consider this hypothetical scenario. So you have a patient who may have a systolic blood pressure of 180 and a diastolic of 80. And in this case, you would want to treat him according to all the guidelines. You have to lower the systolic blood pressure. And based on our associations here, you can hypothesize that you're doing a good thing because you're moving in a favorable direction down to the sweet spot of around 140 millimeter mercury in this particular patient. The problem is that giving antihypertensive medications will also lower the patient's diastolic blood pressure, and as you can see, hypothetically at least, you may be moving the patient in the wrong direction on the diastolic blood pressure mortality association curve. So the question is, which one is dominant? Is it beneficial to lower systolic in a beneficial direction, or is it bad because diastolic is moving in the wrong direction? And in order to examine this, we created this complicated table where you can see on top systolic blood pressure categories and here on the left side the diastolic blood pressure categories. And for each individual combination of systolic and diastolic blood pressure, you will see a hazard ratio compared to this reference point here, reference being a blood pressure of 140 to 150 over 80 to 90. So the hazard ratios are all compared to this point. The reason you have empty cells here is because we just didn't have enough patients to have meaningful results in these extreme groups. And, of course, systolic has to be higher, so you cannot have patients with blood pressures of 80 over 110. So let's take, again, a hypothetical patient here. This patient may have a blood pressure anywhere between 160 to 170 over 70 to 80. And as you see, the relative mortality hazard for this patient would be 1.07, meaning that this patient compared to this particular patient with a blood pressure of 140 over 150 over 80 to 90 has a 7% increased risk of mortality. Now, again, hypothetically, and I have to stress this is observational and we're not actually treating patients, but let's say we lower this patient's blood pressure to these groups. So we want to have the patient have an ideal blood pressure or close to ideal of 140 or so, and this would also lead to a decrease in diastolic blood pressure to, let's say, 50 to 60. And when we examine the risk of mortality associated with this particular combination, what we see that the risk is in fact 10% higher than what it was in the original group. So based on this, we may have some concerns about the diastolic blood pressure driving the overall mortality in the wrong direction in spite of the systolic blood pressure moving in the right direction. And when we examine this to a lot of potential pairwise combinations, in general what we saw is that when the diastolic blood pressure was pushed diagonally below a level of around 70, in general we saw an increase in the hazard ratios associated with that move. Again, I have to emphasize that we didn't actually move patients from one cell to another. These were all separate individual measurements. So this is all hypothesis generating and is not in any way proving that by treating blood pressure to these levels would harm patients. So in conclusion, we saw a J-shaped or U-shaped association for both systolic and diastolic blood pressure in this study. Our ideal systolic pressure was somewhere in the 130 to 150 range. Ideal diastolic blood pressure was somewhere between 70 to 90, depending on which models we looked at. And again, the interesting finding here was that when we considered the pairwise combinations of systolic and diastolic under circumstances where treatment of systolic would result in lowering of diastolic below 70, we saw an association with higher mortality. Hence, what we would suggest is to approach these patients carefully and look at individual characteristics, symptoms of organ hypoperfusion, signs such as increasing creatinine, decreased kidney function in the face of lowering blood pressure or maybe angina or cardiovascular symptoms or dizziness indicating brain hypoperfusion, in which case we should consider that pushing blood pressure to arbitrarily defined targets in any particular individual may actually be hazardous. So the next question would be actual blood pressure control. Again, the previous study was purely observational. We didn't invoke treatment at any level. As we mentioned before, the ideal blood pressure level in hypertensive patients with chronic kidney disease is unclear. Some guidelines, especially years ago, JNC7, for example, advocated stricter control in chronic kidney disease, hypothesizing that this is a high-risk group, and if we assume that high blood pressure is bad, then lower blood pressure has to be better. This, however, did not consider the possibility of the J curve and the potential harm from pushing blood pressure too low. Now, this hypothesis that lower blood pressure is better in patients with CKD hasn't been rigorously tested in clinical trials yet. So we performed an observation modeling of a hypothetical clinical trial, which was published last year. Our objective was to compare outcomes associated with treated systolic blood pressure of less than 120 versus those associated with the currently recommended blood pressure target of less than 140. In this national cohort of prevalent CKD patients. This was an observational study in patients who had prevalent CKD and uncontrolled hypertension, who subsequently received additional prescriptions for antihypertensive medications and experienced a decrease in outpatient systolic blood pressure. So this is, again, somewhat complicated, but we can walk through it fairly quickly. So we started with 650-plus patients, the same cohort that we examined in the previous study. And the first step was to define uncontrolled hypertension. For this, we used most of the criteria employed by the SPRINT trial, which is a large multicenter clinical trial testing exactly this hypothesis. And this was based on blood pressure measurements and usage of antihypertensive medications and the number of antihypertensive medications. Based on this, we identified 300,000 patients who had a baseline eGFR of less than 60 and had uncontrolled hypertension. Of these, 100,000 patients or so had no change in their blood pressure or an increase in systolic blood pressure during follow-up period. The rest, about 18,000 or so, had blood pressure, systolic blood pressure of less than 120 on more than 50% of their follow-up visits. And 176,000 had systolic blood pressures between 120 to 140 at more than 50% of their follow-up visits. So we went from uncontrolled hypertension to these quote-unquote ideal or maybe a predefined target for what you might want to do in a clinical trial aiming for these two targets. Now, because from this data, we didn't know for sure whether these decreases in blood pressure happened as a result of a therapeutic intervention, we next invoked antihypertensive medication prescriptions and excluded those patients who had an unchanged or a decreased number of antihypertensive medications during follow-up. In these cases, you could hypothesize that the decrease in blood pressure may have happened because of an illness, for example. So we were left with 5,760 patients who had a systolic blood pressure less than 120 and an increase in the number of their blood pressure medications, and then 72,000 or so patients who had a systolic blood pressure of 120 to 139 millimeter mercury. Next, what we did a propensity score matching, where we matched patients according to the propensity of having one or the other blood pressure target in order to account for the effect of confounders. And this is kind of a observational study equivalent of maybe a randomization procedure. Not perfect, but as long as we know what the predictors are and they're available to us, it does a good job in matching patients with similar characteristics. So therefore, we ended up with two groups of 5,760 patients each. What you see here is, again, a complicated table that I will not dwell on very longly, but here you see the characteristics of the overall cohort, again, seeing the larger number in the conventional systolic blood pressure arm, and what you'll see is that most of their clinical characteristics were different, which may explain, for example, differences in survival. However, after propensity matching, what we saw here that they were fairly well matched for the most important characteristics, which were their comorbidities. You can see that they're virtually identical in the prevalence of cardiovascular disease, prevalence of heart failure, their comorbidity index, and their estimated GFR level. Not surprisingly, their follow-up systolic and diastolic blood pressures were different because this was the aim of creating these two groups. And then there were some differences, small, but that reached statistical significance for the actual types of antihypertensive medications that were used at baseline. What you see here is the actual measurements of systolic and diastolic blood pressures throughout follow-up. On the x-axis, you see calendar quarters. So four of these will make up a whole year. And what you see here is that there was a difference in systolic and diastolic blood pressure that persisted throughout the entire follow-up, again, both for systolic and diastolic blood pressure. Cause mortality. The top line is the conventional arm, the systolic blood pressure of 120 to 139, and the bottom one is the systolic blood pressure of less than 120. So in this group with chronic kidney disease, patients who had the systolic blood pressure of less than 120 experienced higher mortality during follow-up here. The results were fairly consistent for various subgroups, whether it was younger or older patients, males, females, even though the females were a small number of the overall cohort, sicker or less sick patients, patients with more advanced or less advanced kidney disease, diabetics, non-diabetics, and pre-existing CHF or CAD. So in conclusion, blood pressure that declined to levels corresponding to strict control was associated with significantly higher mortality compared to blood pressure that declined to levels corresponding to usual control. I have to emphasize the wording that we use here. The blood pressure declined. It doesn't necessarily mean that it was a treated blood pressure where the blood pressure was a result of actual treatment. So this is, again, observational and hypothesis generating. And the good news is that the SPRINT trial is, in fact, testing the same hypothesis in a traditional clinical trial setting and is enrolling significant proportions of patients with chronic kidney disease. So we will have exactly the same patient population to be examined, and hopefully we will have results in a few years. Now, finally, I will show you some preliminary data, which has not been published yet, but it is in the process of being published. And this is about the systolic blood pressure levels and outcomes in elderly patients with chronic kidney disease. So chronic kidney disease affects about 10% of the general population. It is more common in the elderly, and it is associated with increased mortality and increased cardiovascular disease risk. It is unclear if age modifies the association of traditional risk factors with outcomes in chronic kidney disease. So we set out to assess the association between systolic blood pressure levels and mortality incident coronary heart disease, incident ischemic strokes, and end-stage renal disease in a group of non-dialysis-dependent chronic kidney disease patients of different age. This was an observational study, again, in the National VA cohort. This was a different cohort. This time we examined a incident CKD cohort. So we captured patients at the first time when they had a measured EGFR that was deemed to be chronic kidney disease. And we examined associations between outpatient systolic blood pressure categories and different outcomes in subgroups categorized by age, again, adjusted for multiple confounders. And I will fairly quickly show you the main results of the study. This was mortality. Again, you see here on the x-axis the different age categories, total of five of them. And what you see here, the different colors, they show the different systolic blood pressure levels from less than 100 to more than 170 in 10 millimeter mercury increments. And what you see here is that mortality indeed has a U-shaped or J-shaped curve type of association, which was fairly consistent in all age groups, although some flattening was seen in more advanced ages. But the same phenomenon that we saw in the previous study was present here, again with an ideal blood pressure of 130 to 140, showing the lowest mortality. What was more interesting was the results that we saw in the vascular and renal endpoints. And this was for coronary heart disease. Again, this was defined as the incidence of coronary artery bypass grafting, PCIs, or acute myocardial infarctions in patients who had no such diagnosis over at least 2 years prior to these events. And what you see here is a linear association as opposed to the J shape we saw on the previous slide. You saw a the lower the better type of phenomenon in which the highest blood pressure is associated with the highest incidence of these events. However, what you will see is that this the shape of this elevation flattens considerably as patients age, whereas we saw a very marked increase in risk in patients who were the youngest, and the oldest age group was hardly any association. And in fact, when you look at the confidence interval, most were not significantly different from the middle category here, which was, again, 130 over 140. Again, the ideal blood pressure seemed to be widening a little bit. In those older than 70, it was more like 130 to 150, and then with an increase in risk in those who had higher blood pressure levels. Stroke probably showed the same phenomenon, maybe even more marked increase in risk from the highest to lowest category in the youngest age group. And again, very neat, very tightly packed confidence intervals in those who are 50 to 60, higher number of patients, obviously. The same as they age is still present in those who are 70 to 80, although again, the ideal here is widening a little bit. But then the association kind of dissipates and goes away in the group that is more than 80 years old. And perhaps the most marked effect was noted with end-stage renal disease, where the lowest levels were below 120 to 130 and were about the same in the younger age groups, and a huge increase in risk seen with the high blood pressure categories with a six-fold higher risk of end-stage renal disease in those who had systolic blood pressures of more than 70. And again, the flattening most markedly seen in the more than 80-year age group, where there was no significant differences except for the group that had a systolic blood pressure of more than 170. In conclusion, it seems that age modifies the association between systolic blood pressure and various outcomes in these patients with chronic kidney disease. The low blood pressure was associated with higher mortality in all age groups. High blood pressure was associated with mortality, somewhat blunted in the elderly. And then the most marked associations were seen for high blood pressure for these cardiovascular endpoint and ESRD. These associations were linear. However, I have to point out that interpreting the associations with the lowest blood pressure categories have to consider competing risk for the higher mortality seen in these groups. Simply put, somebody may have a low risk for a stroke if that person dies before the stroke occurs. So it is a little harder to claim that lowest blood pressures are protective against these without doing specialized analysis or clinical trials. In general, what we saw is that the associations of high systolic blood pressure with all outcomes were blunted in the elderly and were almost absent when age went above 80. And again, this is a fairly significant proportion of our patient populations with CKD nowadays. In summary, we discussed that blood pressure is an important risk factor and treatment target. Blood pressure is measured ubiquitously in essentially all veterans who come to see us, and combined with the rich clinical data that's available in the various databases, blood pressure offers a unique opportunity to perform comparative effectiveness research. Perhaps the future will be the linking of this data with the genetic material that's and the genetic analysis that are being conducted in the Million Veteran Program, which will offer even more exciting opportunities for research. Here is my contact information. If you desire to get in touch with me with any questions, feel free to do so. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Shabbat Kabesi. We'll give everyone a few moments to formulate any questions that they may have for you at this time.
Okay.
And for questions, you can use that questions pane that's on the dashboard on the right-hand side of your screen. If that collapsed against the side of your monitor, just click on that orange arrow at the upper right-hand corner of your screen to open that back up. We have a good amount of time left for questions here, so this is a great opportunity to submit those questions. We will have time to get through a good number of them today. And maybe you answered all of the questions during your presentation and everyone is fully comfortable and knows their, oh, here we go. DeAndre, did you see that one come in there?
No, I don't have it.
I hope we didn't answer all the questions. Otherwise, what would be doing research on?
Okay, the question, did you find it, DeAndre?
No, it's not showing up on my screen.
Okay, the question that we have here, given that even with propensity scoring, that there was a significant difference among different antihypertensives, how do you interpret that? And thank you for a great presentation.
Well, it's hard to interpret because we didn't set out to balance them on those medications. When we did the matching, we used the variables that seem to be most important as confounders. I mean, one could argue to what extent using a calcium channel blocker versus a non-dihydropyridine or a dihydropyridine could have a major impact on mortality in this group, and there is some research in this respect, not very good research, I have to tell you, not clinical trial level. So we didn't consider this a fatal flaw. Obviously, the problem is that if you start matching on a very high number of variables, you will obviously restrict the number of patients that will be eligible. So the nice aspect of having a group of 650,000 patients to start with, it allowed us to do this virtual screening and virtual randomization, and bear in mind that we went from 650,000 down to 5,000 when we just followed the procedures that one might follow in the SPRINT trial, for example, to find suitable patients. So it's not easy to find both substantial number of patients and make them completely identical. And by the way, if we adjusted for those differences that still remained, the results still were significant. So one thing that one could do, obviously, in a propensity score match study is to include the variables that still show differences between the groups in an adjusted analysis.
Okay, Heidi, thanks. I have it up now. It did pop up. Next question. Some national database users typically ignore the first BP measurement. You said something similar today, but you implied something, maybe taking only the last one. Isn't averaging together multiple BPs best for maximizing reliability? And if you average, do you literally take the average systolic or diastolic or use some other summarizing rule?
Well, those are great questions. And it really depends on the circumstances. One problem, obviously, we have when we work with these very large data sets is that we don't have the luxury of checking the individual charts. You will be able to do that if you have a smaller study like a clinical trial. But here we're trying to come up with universal rules because it's not feasible to check the individual charts. So when I said that I would use the last one, that was born out of the observation that within a single clinic visit, repeated blood pressure measurements usually occur only or mostly when the measurer, the person recording the blood pressure, thinks that there might have been a problem with the previous one. So for example, if I check in the patient today in the nephrology clinic and the patient comes in, has a blood pressure measured under standard circumstances, sits there for 10 minutes, nothing's wrong, and then the blood pressure is, let's say, 135 over 75, that will be the single number entered into the system. However, the next patient might run up to the clinic, huffing and puffing, and says, I'm late for my appointment and I couldn't find parking, and that happens more often than we'd like. And then the technician measures the blood pressure and finds that it's 180 over 100 and says, well, this may be high because the patient just rushed up the stairs and it's not considered standard circumstances. So then ask the patient to wait around for 10, 15 minutes and then repeat the blood pressure, and that blood pressure would be 140 over 80, for example. Now, in this case, I would argue that we shouldn't average the blood pressure because it may give us the erroneous sense that this patient has uncontrolled hypertension, whereas it's the 140 over 80 that should be considered. So within the same clinic visit, I tend to favor the last available measurement. Now, if the circumstances are different, for example, a patient is an inpatient where blood pressure are measured routinely several times a day, irrespective of the circumstances, and not repeated because for a specific cause, there, indeed, some kind of an averaging may give us a better sense of incorporating all the information that we get from repeat measurements. And whether you want to consider a plain averaging or use more sophisticated methods such as a time averaging where you weigh the blood pressure measurement according to the length of time that particular measurement was associated with, that really depends on your analysis. And, when they're happening during the same day, then I think you could just use a plain mathematical average. When you average measurements over a longer period of time, you could consider time averaging, and there are formulas to do that.
All right, thank you. All right, when our next question is, can you distinguish patient position for BP measure, sitting, standing, lying in the data, and CDW?
Yes, unfortunately, that's not available. So as I mentioned on that slide, there are no qualifiers in the database. So the only thing you have is a blood pressure level and the time and date when it was measured. You also have information on things like, the clinic that's associated with the provider and so on and so forth, but not the circumstances of the measurement, which include things like which arm it's measured in, whether it was sitting, standing. And again, this poses interesting questions, which we didn't mention. I didn't mention about the sometimes the blood pressure is repeated when orthostatic changes are being checked. So as you can see, you have to be extra careful when you see these blood pressures being repeated in quick succession because currently there is no way to know whether this is done for a reason to correct an error or for a reason to test some physiologic response.
Okay. Thank you. In the follow-up with that question, can you distinguish if BP during a procedure, dialysis, or associated with a clinic visit?
Well, that depends on the code of that's associated with the particular visit. So, if the blood pressure measurement is linked to a dialysis treatment code, dialysis clinic visit code, I think it's 601, if my memory is serving me right, maybe not. Then you could consider those, and if you want to go in that much detail, you will look at the time difference between the individual measurements. So, for example, in a inpatient dialysis setting, you may see blood pressures measured every 15 or every 30 minutes, and if you see several measurements strictly checked every 15 minutes, linked to a clinic code that or a procedure code that signals dialysis, then indeed, you can probably identify with fairly good certainty the circumstances where the blood pressure was measured.
Okay, and do you have any advice for trying to discern the best BP values to use in different contexts?
Well, again, this takes some contemplation because it very much depends on knowledge of how the system works and where blood pressure are measured and what triggers certain measurements. And this is why it helps to I found it very difficult to do this research for people who don't practice and don't work at the VA, because you have to have this knowledge about what really a blood pressure measurement means in dialysis, how that's done, with what frequency, how the clinics are coded and why certain things are done under these circumstances. And remember, everything will be basically just assumptions, which is not the best way, but dealing with millions and millions of measurements, you just have to do your best to identify these circumstances based on your knowledge and experience of the system and biology, and then come up with a rule that is probably sensible.
All right. Do you include ICU readings and nighttime readings in your studies?
Well, I mean, the ones that I showed you are based on purely outpatient blood pressure measurements. And, you know, you're posing a very, very interesting question, something that we're actually studying actively insofar as what inpatient blood pressures mean. And that is a very interesting and valid scientific question, because on the one hand, we round on inpatients and we see their blood pressures, and oftentimes they're high, and we make adjustments. So you could consider this an ideal environment where you have the luxury of checking blood pressures several times a day, every day, and then initiate medications that are administered to the patient for sure, assuming that they don't refuse taking them, so you know that the patient's taking the medication, and then you can check with blood pressure measurements and laboratory measurements to make sure there are no adverse effects and the medication is effective. So in that respect, the inpatient setting is considered by some a perfect environment where antihypertensive medication can be initiated or titrated. On the flip side of it, of course, patients are not inpatients for reasons of treating blood pressure for most of these patients. They are there for some other illness, and that illness may have an independent effect on blood pressure. So if the patient has an infection, their blood pressure may be lower than what it is at home. Or if they're in there with a painful condition, for example, the blood pressures may be higher than when they go home and they don't experience pain. So you could also argue that these blood pressure measurements should really not be considered as indicative of the patient's true blood pressure and should not be used to direct therapy, because we don't know for sure whether they represent the same target that the patient will be exposed to most of the time when they leave the hospital. So there is plenty of equipoise here that warrants further research. And then obviously on the extremes, when you talk about ICU, for example, where patients are in with serious illnesses, and oftentimes the blood pressures are affected in the way that they're causing hypotension, this poses totally different questions. And in fact, we looked at this, it's unpublished data, but you see exactly the opposite association. Perhaps not surprisingly, it's a straight inverse association, meaning that the higher blood pressures are associated with the best survival in the inpatient setting, and especially in the ICU. And again, this is not surprising, and I don't think that anybody would want to initiate chronic antihypertensive management in a ICU patient.
Okay, thank you. And I have another comment here. In a recent investigation I did, there were a number of entries with the same date and time taken, but the SBP and or DBP were different. I also found what you were just mentioning, where there were BPs taken from within 15 minutes of each other. We only kept the second reading.
So I can see that we have others who use this and face the same problem. I know. I've seen the same with the blood pressure measurements done at the same time, down to the second. And I'm not really sure what to do with those. I mean, I ended up averaging them, I think. But there's really no right or wrong answer there. I'm not really sure why those have occurred. It's not a huge number of them, so it may be just chance or typos, somebody not recording the exact time, I guess, or entering the wrong time for the same date. And then for the 15-minute intervals, be careful about it. I guess taking the second measurement gives you some information, I suppose that you skip the first one for a reason similar to why I would have skipped them. But again, if they're measured at these equal intervals, you got to think about something like a dialysis environment, and you may want to check on the clinic code or the encounter code associated with that date and time, and see if you really want to consider blood pressure measurements done during dialysis. I mean, that in itself obviously can be studied, but dialysis patients are a whole different category. They have very, very different associations. I haven't shown you any data about that, but blood pressure is a very interesting question, to put it mildly, in dialysis patients.
Thank you. We have one question left. This question, they ask, how did you restrict just to outpatients? I have not seen a variable that indicates outpatient versus inpatient readings. Have I missed this?
No, you haven't, and I'm sorry I didn't make this clear. So basically, what you do is you find the inpatient-outpatient indicator from different files. Okay, so they're available in MedStats and probably some other ones. Where you have data about inpatient and hospitalizations with admission date, discharge date, and a lot of other things. And you would basically have to merge the data from those data sets with your vital sign databases and basically combine the blood pressure measurement dates with the admission discharge dates. And that way you will be able to identify the inpatient-outpatient measurements.
Okay, thank you. I believe that is all the questions.
We actually have one other question here, DeAndre. We got a question, and what was the answer to the two poll questions?
Oh, yeah, well, it's the answer is it depends. So let me just quickly pull up these questions to see. So first one was the ideal target blood pressure in patients with essential hypertension. So assuming nothing else, and it would be 140 over 90, less than 140 over 90, that's the latest JNC 8 recommendation, although JNC 8 also says that in patients older than 60, you can go with 150 over 90. So it relaxes kind of the requirement there. The other ones, you know, the 130 over 80 used to be the CKD and some other comorbidity, diabetes-related target blood pressure, but the agencies have backtracked from that, so it's now 140 over 90. 120 over 80 is the normal blood pressure, but it's not a treatment target per se. And then the 130 over to 140 is really something that's dear to my heart because it takes into account the J shape. So there are no recommendations like that, although some agencies like the Europeans and some others also caution about over-treating blood pressure, but most guidelines just use the less than 130. My problem with that is obviously that, you know, 80 over 40 is a perfect blood pressure according to those guidelines, and no sensible physician would want their patients to be treated to that low of blood pressure. Then the fourth question would be, in which population is higher blood pressure associated with adverse outcomes? And, you know, most of you said all populations, and I can't fault you for that. I mean, if you say elevated blood pressure, let's say a high blood pressure of, let's say, 180 over 100, yes, in most, as I showed you, in most populations, even CKD patients, this is associated with poor outcomes. But then again, if you say that elevated blood pressure means a higher blood pressure no matter of the blood pressure level, in other words, is a blood pressure of 120 better than a blood pressure of 130? There it's less clear. So that kind of an association is not true for patients with comorbidities, for example, and those with CKD or CHF, we have a marked J shape. So again, on purpose, I worded these questions equivocally so that I would be able to point out some of the controversies that we're facing nowadays.
Right. Thank you. I want to thank you once again, Dr. Shaba Kavesi, for a wonderful presentation today. Our next session is scheduled for Monday, May 4th, from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern. It is entitled Improving Mortality and Ascertainment. We hope that you can join us for that session. Heidi?
Yes, if you all could wait just a few more moments, I'm going to close the session out here, and when I do that, you will be prompted for a feedback form. We really do read through all of your feedback. If you could take a few moments to fill that out, we would very much appreciate it. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today, and we hope to see you at a future HSR&D Cyber Seminar. Thank you.